This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific.
President Franklin Roosevelt addressing Congress and the nation. Today marks 75 years since the attack on Pearl Harbor, which ushered America's entrance into World War II. The bombing of Pearl Harbor killed more than 2,400 people, the worst attack on the U.S. prior to 9/11. And here to talk about the impact that Pearl Harbor had on the nation and here in Cincinnati are Dan Hurley, president of Applied History Associates, and host and producer of 12 Newsmakers on WKRC-TV, and Dr. Bob Miller, adjunct professor in the University of Cincinnati Department of History and author of World War II Cincinnati, From the Front Lines to the Home Front. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dan and Bob, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Good to be here.
Happy to be here.
Dan, it's hard to believe it's been 75 years, and it's still such an impactful point in this country's history.
Well, it is, and one of the interesting things is that because it's 75 years, there's very few people still alive who can speak to it directly. We are losing the generation that remembers on a personal level Pearl Harbor and the World War II experience, but yes, on one level it seems quick. On another level, we're losing the people who are directly connected.
Yeah, Bob?
Mark, I came from an event at the Sharonville Convention, and it was dedicated to people who personally served in World War II. And someone got up and said they had information to the fact that the assemblage we had there, some 75 people, was probably the largest gathering of World War II veterans outside of Hawaii. So that gives you a sense, I mean, statistically, numerically, how shrinking the generation is at this point.
Yeah, now, Bob, Pearl Harbor drew the U.S. into World War II, but wasn't there a sense before the attack that it was only a matter of time, it was inevitable that the United States was going to become involved in the war?
I would not say inevitable. I think it really... what you have to do is really understand that Cincinnati especially was very divided in the public opinion from the onset of the war, 1931, all the way up to the eve of Pearl Harbor. 2 weeks before the attack on Pearl Harbor, the mayor of Cincinnati was sitting on the stage of a downtown auditorium with a group called the America First Committee that was very much against America's entry into war. One of our senators, Robert Taft, had fought Franklin Roosevelt tooth and nail for anything, lend-lease, any kind of effort to assist the Allied war effort, right up until he had to vote for the war major on December 8th. So right after that, public opinion does a 180. The same mayor, James Garfield Stewart, about December 11th, says something to the effect that Japan will become the prevalent language in hell, you know. So, wow. in the aftermath of the attack, he is certainly on board, as Cincinnatians and Americans are. We rally around the war effort at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. And 25 years ago, I interviewed Judge Carl Rubin, who 75 years ago had been the editor of the University of Cincinnati News Record, the student newspaper. And he happened to be in the WCKY studios the morning or the day that of December 7th and saw the teletype coming in announcing this. Well, all during the first semester, the News Record had taken contributions from students and others who were on all sides of this issue, the America First, the Keep Us Out of War. And the next issue has a signed editorial on the front page by Carl Rubin saying everything has now changed and we will not take any more articles that criticize the national policy. We are at war and we were going to support that. So there is this amazing switch that takes place. And even though, you know, you can say that's all, historians, people always hindsight seems so clear. But if you look at what people were saying in the newspapers immediately after this happened, the words that were being used is, I'm shocked, I'm surprised, I can't believe this happened. So there, you know, it's only on a certain level of policy that you can say, well, some people understood that we needed to move this way. But seeing this actually happen and seeing that the attack came at Pearl Harbor as well as other places in the Pacific, that was a total surprise to people. If it had happened just in the Philippines, it might have been one thing. But the fact that the Japanese were able to strike Pearl Harbor was an amazing thing to people.
Well, the 4,000 miles between Japan and Pearl Harbor, is that right? So first off, they thought that was too great a distance,
was one thing.
And then the other notion was the waters were too shallow to launch torpedo attacks of any kind.
Well, in the harbor itself, yeah.
Right.
But, you know, that question of distance, for Americans throughout our history, we had always thought those two oceans had protected us from everything. And now suddenly the Japanese are able to extend their capabilities a distance nobody thought they could or would. And then all of a sudden, cities in the middle of the nation like Cincinnati suddenly felt vulnerable. So civil defense, blackout curtains, all of this, all of a sudden distance meant nothing to people. So it's very interesting to kind of see how all of that can switch very quickly.
One thing I'd add is that I've been doing a lot of work reading the diaries of Raymond Walters, and I think that it's so different for the average person, you know, digesting the full flow of information, and if you're paying attention to it, Pearl Harbor was indeed a shock. But for someone like Walters, he was plugged into this professional and businessmen's club that met every week or so, and they had dignitaries, foreign correspondents that came in, and he had a real sense of what – I don't know, it's more than a premonition, you know, and he's one of these individuals that if you are privileged enough to be in kind of in the loop of news, that you hear the event of Pearl Harbor and you express relief. You're like, finally, it's happened, you know, because there's this sense of the other shoe dropping, you know, that most people didn't really have that sense.
Bob, Dan was talking about how people became concerned about the potential of sabotage or attacks, even in Cincinnati, middle of the country. You write about this in your book. What were some of the other reactions to that? I mean, we actually at one point had the Hamilton County National Defense Council that was in operation.
Right. And I actually got started before Pearl Harbor, but by June of 1942, they had registered upwards into thousands of people and trained them for to be air raid watchers, you know, put out fires. They were ready. And it's so hard to understand that in the immediate aftermath of Pearl Harbor, basically the first 6 months of the war was just a litany of bad news for the United States. You know, we suffered one defeat after the other. Our allies were suffering defeats in the Dutch East Indies. There was no good news to report. All right. So this just accentuated the sense of vulnerability, even in a place like Cincinnati that seems geographically protected. But Franklin Roosevelt goes on the radio and says places like Detroit can be bombed, you know, by Axis bombers. And he's, you know, getting Americans to really guard their homes and their communities.
And local law enforcement became more vigilant during this time period, too.
Protecting bridges, yeah. Utility companies. There is a fear of sabotage at first, but that kind of dissipates.
Right. What was Cincinnati like leading up to December 7th, 1941? What kind of town was this? How would you describe it?
Well, I think it's a city in the mid-20th century that was pretty settled in its ways. It had not, unlike a place like Cleveland or Detroit, it was not a place that was attracting a lot of immigrants. There was not a lot of change. There was a sense of stability. A lot of the industry was very mature, and we're not talking about, you know, innovation and entrepreneurship was not on everybody's lips as it is today. It's a society where lots of people were excluded from influence and participation. So African Americans, women, there were whole very different society in terms of expectations than what we would have today. So placing somebody back, you can't just read backwards what we have and say, oh, well, that's what must have been there before. So this is a very different kind of society. The people who were in control was a much smaller group.
But I would just add that, and I think Dan would agree, that the dynamic changes for Cincinnati really took place in the 19th century. We were a 19th century city right leading up to the Civil War, Porkopolis and everything, and in many ways were our arc was kind of bypassed by Chicago and other cities, and we did kind of settle into this like little Midwestern city. And the war really does transform us and make us more of an important center of transportation with Union Terminal, troop transport, for war production, for smaller component parts, we'll say, that eventually find their way to Chicago and Detroit and places like that. And what that does is open up doors and opportunities that maybe weren't there, certainly during the Depression and even during that period of mobilization in 1940-41, that bring people really out of the woodwork from Appalachia. They move from Kentucky and Tennessee, not just to Cincinnati, but more to Detroit. But Cincinnati is a recipient of that kind of wartime migration.
So Cincinnati becomes more industrial because of the war. Is that right, Bob?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, and I think diversified. I mean, a lot of traditional companies change what they are producing in order to respond to the war effort. And sort of what you get here is it's the nation in arms concept.
The arsenal distinction, of democracy.
Yeah, the distinction between who is in the military and who is not part of the war effort really breaks down. So we see that on the flip side of what American policy in terms of bombing German and Japanese cities. And the justification is everyone's involved in the war effort. And there is a sense of that on our side that, you know, women are going into the factories to work, that everybody's part of the effort. The traditional view was armies were out in the field and civilians were back and were not involved. And that, by World War II, is really breaking down, which then when you project into the Cold War, if that was the lessons, here's what we could do to Germans and Japanese. This is what the Soviets may do to us as part of the Cold War. So there are lessons that are learned here that feed into the future.
So Cincinnati is really a microcosm at this point of what's going
Absolutely.
On all across the rest of the nation.
Right.
So what I like to really remind your listeners and my students about is the fact that, you know, a whole, like, basically generation has grown up in the 21st century, and I call it just a state of perpetual war, which is very different than what Dan's describing that took place in World War II. In our nation's history, World War II and the Civil War are the closest thing that you could describe to as a total war experience. That's what took place in Europe. That's what took place in Europe during World War II. And Franklin Roosevelt was able to, you know, it was the, if we're not careful, the war is going to come to our shores. That was like always the constant threat to motivate people. And that's how we got everyone on board. That's why we blurred the distinction between the man or the woman putting on factory overalls or putting on a military uniform. Everything was equally valuable to the war effort. Everyone was a stakeholder in this kind of situation of national emergency, and we don't feel that today. You know, we're told to go to the mall and carry on our lives as normal. That's a victory for our way of life, our standard of living. That's showing a defeat to terrorism if we are not afraid to go out and maintain our daily schedule. So it's very different.
It's a lot of differences.
It's very different when you're trying when you're trying to educate, you know, a generation, a young generation today about what that that collective experience was like in the 1940s.
Sounds like that to you. That's why Pearl Harbor is still relevant as a historical
Oh, absolutely. You know, someone asked me why a long time ago, why World War II? Why is that your thing? And I said, this is the transformative event of the 20th century, because whether you know it or not, we're still dealing with the aftershocks of that event in our lives today.
September 11th and Pearl Harbor, I think, have similar impacts.
Yeah. Well, Dan and Bob, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Dan Hurley, president of Applied History Associates and host and producer of 12 Newsmakers on WKRC-TV, and Dr. Bob Miller, adjunct professor in the University of Cincinnati Department of History and author of World War II Cincinnati, From the Front Lines to the Home Front. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. Pete Reitmeier was the producer for today's show. Belinda Kai was the assistant producer. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Findlay Kitchen, a culinary incubator located in Findlay Market, is an 8,000-square-foot shared-use kitchen space with commercial-grade equipment, open to food entrepreneurs of all levels. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll learn more about Findlay Kitchen and the local chefs using its facilities. We'll also talk with Marine Lieutenant Colonel Amy McGrath. The Notre Dame Academy graduate was recently inducted into the Kentucky Aviation Hall of Fame. That's Cincinnati Edition, Thursday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.